from the Land-Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois. This is the Closing Market Report. It is the 14th day of September 2010. I'm Todd Gleason. In a few moments, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Wayne Nelson. He's at L&M Commodities in New Market, Indiana. And Stephen Platt of Archer Financial Services will join us to take up the energy markets. In just 26 minutes, meteorologist Don Day will join us for a look at the agricultural weather forecast. And then in the second half of our program, we call that the farming world. We'll talk about box turtles. That's right.
In reptiles.
Box turtles during the farming world. And along the way today, we'll check in with the statisticians from Illinois, Nebraska, and Minnesota to get some updates on how crop progress and harvest is.
Other than this is a deadly cold.
It all happens right here
was,
on this in Tuesday
experimental studies
of the Closing Market
Report.
It is a production of Illinois Public Media from the University of Illinois.
Learnard Seed Service supports agricultural programs as an additional service to its customers. Learnard Seed Service is an independent dealer providing DeKalb and Asgrow seed products, including Genuity SmartStax corn hybrids, to farmers throughout East Central Illinois. Learnard Seed Service, 217-497-2270.
Checking the numbers as they settled up in Chicago on this Tuesday afternoon. Futures like this: September wheat at 7.04 and a half, down 9 1/4 in the soft red. December at 7.36, down 9 cents, and the March at 7.65 for the wheat, 8 3/4 lower. September wheat up 2 1/4 at 7.59 3/4. September corn today, 4.78, 8 3/4 higher. December at 4.95, 11 1/2 higher. The March at 5.08 1/4, up 11 1/2, and the May, 5.11 1/2, up 11 3/4. July corn, 5.14 1/4, 11 1/2 cents higher. December futures up 11 for next year at $4.67 from the corn pit. September soybeans, $10.25, down 1/4. November at 10.35 1/2, up 1. January at 10.45 1/4, up 1 1/4. The March at 10.53 1/2, up 1 1/4. And the May at 10.57, 1 3/4 higher. July beans at 10.61, up 3/4. September bean meal at 2.90, down 680. September oil down 14 cents at 41.20. Mercantile exchange numbers: October live cattle futures, 98.20, up 75 cents. December at $100.80, up 42 1/2 a hundredweight. September feeder cattle at 112.15, down 20. October's at 112.10, down 27 1/2. And October lean hogs today at $78.70, $2.40 higher. December at $76.40, up $2.10. You're listening to the Closing Market Report. It is a production of Illinois Public Media from the Urbana-Champaign campus of the University of Illinois. Here's what the outside markets look like at this hour. Crude oil futures nearby October contract, $76.77 a barrel, down 42 cents. October ethanol at $2.05 1/2, up 4 6/10 cents. Natural gas at $3.94 9/10, 1 1/10 cents higher. Heating oil or diesel fuel at $2.12 9/10 cents, up 6 1/10 cents. And gold futures today at $1,269.70 an ounce, up $24.60. The Dow Jones Industrial Average at 10,563 now stands just about 20 points higher. The dollar at 81.08 is down 0.77. And the CRB index for the afternoon at 280.13 is up 2.57 for the day. If you get the opportunity to make it up to Mazan, that's in Grundy County, the Grundy County Farm Bureau is sponsoring this evening one of our Ag Outlook panels. Bill Gentry of Risk Management Commodities will be there, Kurt Kimmel of Bates Commodities, and Jackie Vakes of Stuart Peterson. I'll be hosting the program at the American Legion Post tonight in Mazan. Kicks off, I think, at 6:30 with pizza, and then 7 o'clock we'll go a couple of hours with those three folks and talk about the commodity markets. It's free, open to the public, so if you want to drop by the Legion Post in Mazan, Illinois, that's in Grundy County, please do so this evening. Here's what the weather forecast looks like for the two-state region, as put out by the National Weather Service. They say mostly sunny skies today, a high of 81 degrees. Tonight, partly cloudy, low of 54. Tomorrow, partly sunny, high of 82. Tomorrow night, showers and thunderstorms. Mostly cloudy, though, low around 61 degrees. Thursday, a 40% chance of showers and thunderstorms. That before 1 o'clock, mostly cloudy, a high near 76. South winds then between 11 and 18 miles an hour. And then Thursday night, mostly cloudy with a low of around 55 degrees.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 90 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
On this Tuesday afternoon, time to check the agricultural futures markets. Wayne Nelson of L&M Commodities out of New Market, Indiana, is here. Good afternoon to you, Wayne.
Why, good afternoon, Todd.
Big day in Chicago. Corn futures rallied, and it looks like the commercials led the way, so I guess that's demand-driven. Is that right?
This has been a very demand-driven corn market, Todd. We continue to see the export sales, an interest in export sales, tremendously big. We continue to see the yields being disappointing. And with the feed wheat shortage in the world, just a whole different ballgame than we thought was out there probably 30 days ago.
Is $5 enough? Let's see. We have March, May, July, all above $5. December corn, just a nickel shy of that. Will it make it first to $5? And then how much above it might those futures try to climb?
Well, I think, large advisory firms and people in Chicago are saying that it probably could go another quarter on top of this, and then we'll sort of sit back, take a look, and see if we think that any rationing is starting to begin or not. There was one advisory firm today that put out on their squawk box that they're trying to take the ethanol people out of this market to take that corn to put into the feed world. So we'll see if that's actually what's going on, but that was one of the things that was on the newswires today.
Yeah, that was actually a question I had, because while corn futures are climbing to $5, the crude oil futures dropped 39 cents today, and they're at 76.80 or thereabouts. I suppose it doesn't really make much sense, or doesn't it? I take that back. I don't suppose anything. Can the ethanol producers produce ethanol that will be blended into the marketplace at that kind of price differential?
Well, it depends on whether they were hedged with the, you know, earlier to fund their purchases. They had plenty of opportunities to lock in corn at much lower levels than this, Todd. Will be sort of how well they bought ahead.
Now, we usually think of the livestock sector as the place where the rationing begins, and maybe that's changed a little bit, I suppose, over time with consolidation in the pork industry. The poultry industry consolidated a long time ago. Dairy is close, but the beef cattle producers are the one that may be under the pinch, I would guess, because there are so many more of them.
I think that basically we've got all of the livestock markets that are scrambling either for coverage or are going to be facing some very tight margins, again, with this high price in the corn market and also the high price in the bean meal market, Todd. So, you know, that's going to be one of the places. If you remember on the report last Friday, we did knock $100 million out of the feed and residual number.
Indeed, we did. So let's come back to the numbers for corn and soybeans. Producers will be bringing it across the scale, both crops now. What should they do as they bring it in town?
Well, we like at this point to still be holders of corn. We feel there's probably a little more room in the corn market. The bean market is the one that's very hard for us to decide what to tell people because, number one, we feel that the corn market is just like today, brought us from a negative into a positive for the day, but the fundamentals are much different in the bean market than they are in the corn market. First off, we've got a lot more chance of a bigger, much bigger carryover. The yields are doing much better than the corn is in comparison, and it looks like our carryover is going to double compared to this year when we look at it. But the positive things are that the rain isn't falling for to start planting beans in Brazil, in South America. And we're seeing a lot of meal demand for the first time out of Vietnam. And so we've still got some positive things in the bean market. But if I had a choice and I had to pay storage at the elevator on one or run out of bins at home, I'd be selling beans and holding my corn.
Anything else to add before I let you go?
That's about it today, Todd.
Thank you much, Wayne. Wayne Nelson is with L&M Commodities out of New Market, Indiana. Joined us here on the Closing Market Report. Happens each and every Tuesday afternoon. If you're in the Mazan, Illinois area, that's in Grundy County. The Farm Bureau there is sponsoring an ag panel this evening. And you're invited to come. Pizza at 6:30, 7 o'clock there at the Legion Post in Mazan in Grundy County. Please do come out and join us. I'll host the program, and Jackie Vakes will be there. Dave Gentry will be there, as well Kurt Kimmel. It all happens at 6:30 or 7 at the American Legion Post in Mazan tonight.
Agricultural programs are made possible by First Midwest Bank, serving Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and Moline. More information is available from Doug Slayton in Galesburg at 309-341-5003. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report. It is a production of Illinois Public Media. Please do visit our website. The address is willag.org. Let's update now what the state statisticians in the Midwest had to say about the corn and bean crops last week. By the week's end, NAS now reports 93% of the corn crop was at or beyond the dented stage. That was 29 points ahead of last year, 10 points ahead of the five-year average. They note that beneficial growing conditions throughout much of the major corn-producing area of the Midwest continues to produce rapid crop development. An additional 9 percentage points of the crop had reached maturity during the last week for a total of 52% by the week's end. Nationally, maturity development was 40 percentage points ahead of last year, 20 points ahead of the five-year average. Of the 18 major corn-producing states, only Colorado and Texas were behind the five-year average. 11% of the nation's crop had been harvested by September the 12th, 8 percentage points ahead of last year and 5 points ahead of the five-year average. At least half of the corn crop had been harvested in Kentucky, North Carolina, Tennessee, and Texas, with Tennessee most advanced at 72% complete. Overall, 68% of the corn crop reported in good to excellent condition, down just slightly from both ratings last week and from this same time last year. Nationally, on the soybeans, leaves were dropping on 38% of the crop by September the 12th, 22 points ahead of last year, 8 points ahead of the five-year average. Leaf drop in Indiana and Kentucky significantly ahead of normal at 28 and 33 points ahead of the five-year average, respectively. Overall, 63% of the soybean crop reported in good to excellent condition, down slightly from the ratings last week and 5 points below this same time last year. Now here are the statisticians.
This is Tyler Armstrong with USDA NAS, Iowa Field Office, with the Iowa Crops and Weather Report for the week ending September 12, 2010. Following a summer of high temperatures and humidity, cooler weather has greeted Iowa the past few weeks. Last week, average highs were in the upper 70s, with average lows dropping into the low 50s. Along with cooler temperatures, Iowa experienced several breezy days that aided crop drying. Scattered precipitation fell throughout Iowa during the week, with the northwest corner of Iowa receiving around 2 inches. However, most of the state received less than an inch. Rainfall amounts were not enough to keep producers from getting in the field to harvest their 2010 crop. During the 5.4 days suitable for field work, farmers continued chopping silage and picking seed corn, while others harvested early planted corn and soybean. With acres being harvested, crop conditions remain mostly good. Corn is rapidly maturing and progress remained ahead of normal, with 62% of the acres now safe from frost, which is 19 days ahead of last year and 10 days ahead of the five-year average. Moisture content of all corn in the field is estimated at 27%, while moisture content of corn being harvested is estimated at 23%. Soybeans are also maturing quickly with the aid of recent weather conditions. 74% of the soybean acres have turned color, ahead of last year's 59% and the five-year average of 68%. Leaves have begun to drop in 32% of the soybean acres, 4 days ahead of last year and 2 days ahead of the five-year average. Again, this has been Tyler Armstrong with USDA NAS, Iowa Field Office, with the weekly Crops and Weather Report for the week ending September 12, 2010.
This is Mike Clark with the Illinois Field Office of USDA NAS, reporting on the Illinois Weather and Crops Report for September 12, 2010. Cooler conditions continued over much of the state last week. Many farmers were able to take full advantage of the favorable weather. The corn crop has now reached 79% mature, and harvest picked up steadily last week, with 18% of the crop now harvested, compared to 7% last week. Harvest varies from less than 10% in northern areas of the state to around 25% in central areas and 50% in the southern areas of the state. Soybeans turning yellow reached 73% with 42% shedding leaves. Soybean harvest has reached 3%. This has been Mike Clark with the Illinois Field Office of USDA NASS as of September 12th.
This is David Biar of USDA's National Agricultural Statistics Service with the crop weather report for the week ending September 12, 2010. Temperatures early in the week dipped below freezing in parts of the panhandle and southwest, impacting crops not yet mature. Corn harvest was underway in the southeastern third of the state and was advancing north and west. In Panhandle counties, wheat seeding was near 50% complete, and dry bean and millet harvest were active. Irrigated corn conditions rated 84% good or excellent, while dryland corn rated 80%. Corn in the dent stage was 92%, while corn harvest was now underway at 2%. Soybeans turning color were 69%, and soybeans dropping leaves were at 20%. Winter wheat seeded reached 25%. This is David Biar of USDA's National Agricultural Statistics Service, Nebraska Field Office in Lincoln.
This is Kathy King, agricultural statistician from the USDA NASS Minnesota Field Office with the crop weather report for the week of September 13. Cool, wet weather continued this past week. As of September 12, rainfall was above normal for most Minnesota observers, except for a few southeastern counties. Precipitation amounts were heaviest in the northwestern part of the state, where rainfall was 2.3 inches above normal. Rainfall amounts were also heavy in west central and north central regions, receiving 1.6 and 1.4 inches of rain above normal, respectively. Statewide, temperatures dropped to below normal levels for the week. The average temperature for the week was 57.1, 3.2 degrees below normal. 94% of corn was in the dent stage, compared to 52% last year and 83% for the five-year average. Corn in the mature stage was 28%, compared to 1% last year and 20% average. Corn silage was 64% harvested, compared to 19% last year and 45% average. Corn was rated in 53% good and 37% excellent condition, nearly equal to last week. 79% of soybeans were turning yellow, compared to 59% last year and 74% average. 37% of soybeans were shedding their leaves, compared to 14% last year and 33% average. Soybeans were 6% mature, compared to 0% last year and 8% average. Soybeans were rated in 57% good and 31% excellent condition, nearly equal to last week. This has been Kathy King of the USDA NASS Minnesota Field Office.
And I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. You're listening to the Closing Market Report on a Tuesday afternoon.
Support comes from Stuart Peterson, since 1985 offering strategic commodity consulting and marketing services to help producers manage market opportunities and risks. The firm develops strategies customized to each client's goals and operation size. More information is available at www.stuart-peterson.com.
Up next, you know, there's a number in the USDA reports that many in the industry find curious. It relates, as you'll hear, to what's left over from last year's corn crop. I spoke with ag economist Daryl Good about the anomaly. The corn crop being harvested right now in the U.S. should be the biggest on record at 13.16 billion bushels. It'll be worth more than any other crop, too. USDA says the average cash price paid to farmers for the 2010 corn crop will range from $4 a bushel to $4.80 a bushel. The midpoint on that range of $4.40 is 50 cents higher than first predicted in August by the agency, says University of Illinois ag economist Daryl Good, and it's the highest ever on record.
That's pretty impressive. That would be a record high corn price with the largest crop we've ever harvested. So I think it continues to speak to the strong demand that we have for corn domestically and in the world when we can increase production We consume more than we produce, and we see higher prices. That's just classic strong demand market.
Demand driven by increasing use for ethanol production and the overseas export market, but not by domestic livestock production.
Basically, on both old crop and new crop, USDA raised their export number on corn. I think both were expected because we have the weekly numbers and the census numbers on the old crop. We knew we were running a little bit ahead of USDA's projection, but not much, 5 million bushels. Jumped new crop exports, 50 million. Old crop ethanol use raised 35 million bushels. The biggest change was a 100 million bushel cut in feed and residual use for next year. So USDA, I think, must be implying that the higher prices may cut into feed demand just a little bit as we move forward. Certainly probably will not cause any liquidation of livestock numbers, but will probably prolong any expansion in livestock numbers.
Historically, Good says corn usage by the domestic livestock base is the very first item to contract when the price of corn is high. And more likely than not, it is the place where the numbers will continue to go down as the prices go up.
Clearly, that's the case. When we've seen periods of extremely high prices or short supplies in the past, for the most part, the adjustment is made in the domestic livestock industry. Right now, domestic use for ethanol is pretty locked in because of mandates and tax credits. If those are extended beyond December 31st, we'll keep that demand strong over very high prices. Similar with exports, we think exports are sensitive to prices and exchange rates, but they're really not. Importers tend to buy what they need. They certainly adjust the timing of when they buy based on price expectations, but they have to meet domestic consumption needs, and they will do that over a very wide price range. So the adjustment tends to get forced back to the domestic livestock industry.
USDA dropped the number of bushels of corn used for feed in the September reports by 100 million. For University of Illinois Extension, I'm Todd Gleason.
Agricultural information is made possible with support from ADM. ADM thanks America's farmers because everything they do starts with you.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report. It is a Tuesday. Time to check the energy markets. From Archer Financial Services, Mike McElroy is with us to talk about that very quickly. Thanks, Mike, for joining us this afternoon under the category of oops, by the way.
Yeah,
that was
yeah.
a wrong feature story. You don't know that, Mike, but the rest of them heard it yesterday and today. I hope it was worth hearing again. I'll get to something else with it tomorrow. Let's talk about ethanol because it sort of fits in with what we have in mind to discuss quickly this afternoon. We've got $4.80 and $5 corn, I suppose, at that. Can you think ethanol producers can go ahead and make ethanol and continue to make money?
Well, they are at the moment, and I think they can. I mean, we don't have to worry about the crude price so much as the ethanol price itself, which, you know, recently here at about 189.5, still around a 10% margin there with compared to the RBOB. So, you know, maybe if we start pushing up into that 5.25 area on the corn is when some of your smaller producers start to lose money.
And then there's the thing that the industry, the oil industry, can do. They can move the RINs around just a bit so they can take what they've purchased in the past and move it forward on certificates for ethanol blending?
Yes, a very convoluted system, but it's something that they certainly will do. And I believe that some of the fears of, well, not I don't know how founded they are, but the questions as to what the government is going to do here in terms of the subsidies is definitely going to push those RINs higher.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report. It is a Tuesday afternoon. We're talking to Mike McElroy. He's with Archer Financial Services in Chicago, Illinois. Mike, another question for you. Let's talk about the price of gasoline at the pump. It's gone up quite a little bit over the last couple of days. I wonder if that is a shortfall as they move from summer to winter mixes or what's happening there.
Well, what really is the main impetus behind that has been this leak in the crude oil pipeline in the Romeoville, Illinois. It's kind of cutting into the supplies to the Midwest refining area, and kind of couple that with this spring, you know, where there were good margins and there wasn't a lot of downtime at the refiner, so they're going to have to get in some downtime this fall. So you put those two together, and it kind of has pushed these prices up.
Can you tell me more about the leak?
At this point, the leak, the issue may not be as large as some people want to. They can bypass this leak, but the problem is at this moment, I mean, that pipeline, it probably brings in, I believe, it's somewhere in the area of 8% of the supplies from Canada into the Midwest. So it is a sizable shutdown at the moment. So, you know, the thought would be that it's a short-term blip in prices, but we will see if that's what actually pans out.
Okay. Anything else that we ought to be watching in the energy markets before I let you go for the day?
You know, this nat gas prices have been low for a long time, which has probably helped these ethanol producers, but we're starting to see signs maybe that market could start to firm up.
That on natural gas. Thank you much.
All right.
Mike McElroy filling in today at Archer Financial Services for Stephen Platt, who we usually talk to on a Tuesday afternoon about the agricultural energy markets. We do appreciate him taking that time. If you get the opportunity, visit our website. The address is willag.org. And don't forget to come and visit us tonight in Mazan at the American Legion Post, 6:30 and 7 o'clock for pizza and then our meeting. It's open and free to the public. You're listening to the Closing Market Report. It is a Tuesday afternoon, Don Day, with Day Weather out of Cheyenne, Wyoming, joins us from his offices this afternoon. It is a beautiful day here again. There have been some hints of rainfall, but I don't think there'll be much, if any, at all. What do you see?
Well, certainly through the next 24 hours, 36 hours or so, no. But as we get into late tomorrow, as we get into tomorrow night and Thursday, there's going to be some areas of showers and thunderstorms moving into the Midwest and Corn Belt. This will be especially true overnight Wednesday and into Thursday morning.
And if you go a little further out, what do you see? More rainfall, or do we dry back out? And with this little bit of rain that's coming in the next 24 to 48 hours, is there much precip involved?
Well, there will be two areas where there will be heavier moisture. Looks like portions of Minnesota, northern and central Iowa, Wisconsin, those areas, maybe northern Indiana, as well as northern Illinois. And then another patch of heavier moisture will likely go across Missouri, southern Illinois, into southern Indiana, then into southwestern Ohio, probably looking at a half inch to three quarters to about an inch of rain with those showers and storms.
Hey, take me back into Minnesota, because I made note from the statistician's report that we heard earlier in this broadcast that they had better than average rainfall last week. They've been kind of cool, a little wet. Maturity is doing fine there, but I suppose we're more worried about whether they can get in and harvest. I don't know that they've had enough rainfall to really deter that at this point, but maybe you can give us a better idea.
Well, I think that certainly there might be a few areas that could be a little bit muddy, but I don't think that the system is going to be one of those slow-moving, soaking-type storms that'll really cause the rain to accumulate a lot. So it'll be a rather quick-moving system moving through. If there's any area of Minnesota that may get a little soggy, it'll be the far southern counties.
Let's stay with harvest season and move instead to China this time around. What kind of conditions are they working under?
Well, they have had a fairly active late summer and early fall in terms of moisture that's been a little bit heavy in some areas. Now, the trend in China over the next week or two is drier. However, not completely dry. There's still going to be some weather to contend with in China with harvest. If there's any area to watch, it'd be the central and western growing areas.
Let's move from there eastward and check in on the growing areas in Russia and Ukraine, maybe Europe, where they had some dry weather, especially in Russia. We know that with the wheat growing regions. Has that been relieved at this point?
It has. It has cooled off, and there has been some rain. And right now, the Ukraine and most of eastern Europe has favorable chances for, even in some spots, a little bit above normal precip. Now, this will be especially true as you get into the western Ukraine, as you get into the far western reaches of eastern Europe. But also some portions of Russia's wheat-growing areas are going to get some precipitation as well. And the relief from the heat is not completely gone away. We're still looking at some areas of Russia and eastern Europe that will have above normal temperatures, but not at the levels they had earlier this summer.
And let's finish our globe-trotting in South America, where they have started planting soybean.
Well, there's not going to be a lot of precipitation over the next couple of weeks down south. There will be some shower activity in portions of Argentina, southern Brazil, but it's going to be a little bit dry here over the next week to 10 days.
Thank you so much, Don, for taking the time with us. Don Day is with Day Weather out of Cheyenne, Wyoming. Joins us here on the Closing Market Report each and every Tuesday afternoon. Stay with us if you can for the farming world. Today, we'll talk about turtles. I'm Todd Gleason. You're listening to The Farming World. It is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm U of I Extension's Todd Gleason, in today with a visiting instructor in veterinary medicine here on campus, working with some interesting kinds of animals, reptiles, in fact. Matt Allender is with us. He joins us from, well, the Vet Med Studio. It's very nice to have you with us via our Skype line. Thanks so much for being with us, Matt.
Nice to be with you, too.
Well, let's talk about some of the work you've got going on now with reptiles, box turtles in particular. First, you know, why are we here on this campus working with box turtles? What is it that you're looking at and wanting to know?
Well, box turtles, I think we all have probably some sort of emotional attachment to turtles from when we were young. But that's developed in me over the course of the last 30 years to an appreciation of figuring out what are their threats in the environment and specifically what are the health parameters that are present in free-ranging populations, kind of as a measure of ecosystem health. And so what I'm interested in is general box turtle knowledge, what is affecting them. And recently we found significant diseases that are affecting the population, causing declines. And so I've been investigating those more thoroughly myself, as well as with some students and collaborators.
You know, most will be familiar from print stories and news stories over the years about frogs and the life of the frog, some of the problems that particular animal has had and how it indicates the health of an environment. You think that reptiles and box turtles have sort of the same kind of indicators in their life cycles?
Oh, most definitely. Actually, box turtles are unique in that they use both terrestrial and aquatic habitats. And so they have been indicated as a premier biosentinel. Or biomonitor animal in order to figure out ecosystem health, toxicities, health-related emerging infectious diseases, those types of things. So box turtles play an integral role, and we're just starting to elucidate some of those primary roles.
So what kind of diseases do they get?
Well, you mentioned amphibians and frogs specifically, and their amphibian declines that are well known across the world. One of the two diseases that has been linked for amphibian declines is something called rhinovirus. And that's what I'm specifically looking at, because we've seen significant declines in turtle and tortoise populations in the United States. And it's just the tip of the iceberg of what we're looking at so far, because nobody is able to identify specific populations as easily and with mass die-offs as easily as they are with amphibians. And so it takes a little bit of extra work, but that's what we're trying to do.
And once you've done that, what can it tell us?
Well, we first have to figure out how prevalent it is in the population. What's it affecting? If there's specific age groups that are affected, affecting adults versus juveniles, it would lead us to different ecosystem conclusions, as well as if there are different males or females, if they're differently affected, then that may have reproductive effects that may have long-term sustainability. And box turtles obviously play a key role in the ecosystem, and while I'm well-versed in many of the ecological aspects, I don't even think anyone is smart enough to know all of the roles that box turtles play. And so it's important for us to preserve them until we do figure that out.
There are many types of box turtles. Are you looking at one particular type or one variation that shows up here in our part of the world?
Yeah, so in Illinois, we have the eastern box turtle, and then in the northwest near the Quad Cities, there's the ornate box turtle. And so I've been concentrating mainly on the eastern box turtle. It's the one that the species in all across North America that has been linked to declines and specifically having problems with rhinovirus and disease outbreaks.
So it's been linked to declines. Do we Do we know how much the population has dropped, or can we estimate it?
No, it's hard to say. In certain surveys, it can affect a great number of a population. Is that rhinovirus causes significant mortality, and in one population in Pennsylvania, there was a known population of about 40 animals, and 35 died within a 3-month period, all from rhinovirus. But then after that period, the animals that survived didn't die. It wasn't an ongoing outbreak. Similarly, in Tennessee, which is where I am doing a lot of my research due to the high numbers of turtles that are in those areas, we can see population prevalences from 0% in some areas because it's not there yet, or as high as, 15 or 20%. And we just don't know. It's such a fatal disease and such a fatal virus that once it comes encountered with a box turtle, it's been our experience that animal then dies within about 3 weeks.
I suppose you're looking at where the virus comes from and why it transfers through populations, and what that has to do with the ecology and how the ecology of a certain area has changed. Is that the premise?
Yeah, and so there's so many different areas that we're liking to look at right now. I'm doing an epidemiologic study looking at many different parameters, including habitat health and parameters that may affect health. Currently we're looking at, as in addition to the eastern box turtle, other carrier species. And so you mentioned the persistence in the population or how it spreads into populations. And we just don't know. It's not known for amphibians either. But we think that there's going to be a carrier species, or it could be transmitted by insect vectors, mosquitoes, ticks, those types of things. There's still a lot of work to be done, and we're just getting into a lot of that.
So the idea here is that amphibians, as we know, the frogs, sure, the reptiles, the turtles or the box turtle that you're studying, and their populations are changing. They're both declining. There are some that believe, and I suppose you may be among these, and I won't cast aspersions one way or the other, that these are early indicators of the health of the ecology or the environment around. Why is the rhinovirus part of that, or are you trying to define whether that is part of that change?
Yeah, I think it's too early to tell for reptiles. Amphibians, typically, the most outbreaks with rhinovirus in amphibians in North America have been in salamanders and in the western United States as well. And they found different routes of transmission and other things, specifically pond substrates, so soil and dirt from ponds, from infected ponds, can infect amphibians that have never seen the virus. And so we know specifically, like hiking and other things, boating, things that move pond substrates, soil and water from one naive or one infected area to a naive area can infect and cause outbreaks in new areas. That was brought to light when there was an outbreak in tiger salamanders in Arizona that was genetically linked, molecularly linked to bait salamanders that were brought from a fisherman from Indiana, and then they brought to Arizona, and it caused the death of thousands of amphibians that population wasn't able to sustain. Mm-hmm. So I think there those indications are that there's a detriment in the ecosystem, and those are probably anthropogenic, human-induced causes, that's what we really want to get to the heart. Is there something that we can do about it? Is this natural variation? Disease has been around for millions of years, and whether or not the current prevalences that we're seeing are natural variation, or if they're due to things that we can actually affect to reduce the populations, or things that we're actually causing that we can stop doing and affect the populations in a positive way.
I called it rhinovirus earlier. You'll have to forgive me.
No, it's okay.
And I switched to rhinovirus. I tried to give them a cold, I guess.
Well, that's actually what their clinical signs are. So it's spelled R-A-N-A, like the frog, rana virus.
Mm-hmm.
And the clinical signs in turtles are typically like a cold. They have a runny nose. They have runny eyes. They have kind of white, crusty we call them plaques in their mouth. It's not unlike some of the other diseases we see with turtles, but so it's not specific to rhinovirus, but it very much looks like a cold. And so if you were to come across one that looked like that, you would think it had a cold. In my experience, we haven't been able to find flu yet in reptiles, well, specifically turtles. It's been found in alligators, but I'm sure we will. But it very much looks like a cold.
That's kind of fun.
Yeah.
Other than this is a deadly cold.
Yeah. There was in experimental studies in red-eared sliders who are not nearly as susceptible, it killed 83% of the population within 3 weeks. And that's quite quick for a reptile. With mammals and birds, things happen very quickly. If an animal gets a fatal infection, they usually succumb within a week, days to a week, if it's a serious viral infection, untreated. Reptiles typically, with all of their infections, typically take weeks to months. In fact, for an example, a broken leg in a person can take, most people think, 2 to 3 months to heal at most. In a reptile, it can take up to 3 years just to heal normally. And that's because their metabolism is dictated by their environment and they do things a lot slower. The fact that this rhinovirus can cause such a pronounced mortality so quickly, it really is a significant disease.
Wow. It moves quickly through the population, but other things don't. Hey, I've got another question for you. It's related. I was reading the blog of one of the students, I suppose. I'm not quite certain who it came from. But they were talking about how you go about finding turtles. It's not an easy task, I wouldn't think.
No, and that's one of the problems that we're having identifying the true prevalences or incidence of the disease is most turtles are found through biologists through what we call mark recapture or visual encounters. And so someone spends a certain amount of man hours to go out and they just walk through known territory and known habitat. And they can do transects going up and down certain areas and marking that off and finding turtles that way. In our experience in the habitat that we're working at, that usually leads usually yields a turtle once every 2 man hours. But what we've used in Tennessee recently is a group of turtle searching dogs, or Boykin Spaniels, the state dog of South Carolina, something I did not know. I don't know that we have a state dog in Illinois.
No, but, I don't think so.
Wonderful little dogs, extremely gentle. And they had been trained by their owner to search out and find turtles. And so for an example, last year when we went out one of the days, we took 4 turtles and within 60 minutes we had 16 turtles. And it's just remarkable. It actually helps us to do our job better so that we can increase our numbers. And those turtles were in areas that we were going to do transects in and would never have found. They were underneath leaves, hidden underneath logs or trees, those kind of things, extremely difficult. But these dogs were able to pick up the scent of the turtles and follow the scent until they were able to identify the turtle, in which case we picked them up and were able to sample them, do their normal measurements, weight, length, those kind of things, and take a blood sample and a swab from the mouth.
We're talking with Matt Allender today. He's a visiting instructor in veterinary medicine here on the Urbana-Champaign campus of the University of Illinois. We'll return in a moment with more here on The Farming World.
Support for the Closing Market Report comes from AgriGold Hybrids, featuring the AgriGold Giants, a group of 5 new hybrids designed to meet the performance standards of yield, health, and consistency required by Midwestern corn growers. More information is at AgriGoldGiants.com or at 800-262-7333.
It's Eat a Hoagie Day. It's also National Cream-Filled Donut Day. Hanson Gregory and American claimed to have invented the ring-shaped donut in 1847 aboard a lime-trading ship when he was only 16 years old. Gregory was dissatisfied with the greasiness of donuts twisted into various shapes and with the raw center of regular donuts. He claimed to have punched a hole in the center of the dough with the ship's tin pepper box and later taught the technique to his mother. On this day in agricultural history in 1752, the calendar in Britain and the American colonies jumped from September 2nd to September 14th as the Gregorian calendar was officially adopted, correcting an 11-day discrepancy that existed with most of the rest of the world, which had adopted the Gregorian calendar 170 years earlier. In 1849, Ivan Petrovich Pavlov was born. Pavlov's work with dogs actually started as a study of digestion. He performed a series of experiments on dogs to show how digestive secretions are regulated. Pavlov noted that dogs began to salivate if they were able to see, smell, or taste food. Pavlov suspected that digestion must be partially controlled by sensory stimuli, what he called a conditioned reflex. And that's this day in agricultural history.
This is the Farming World. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. We're talking today with Matt Allender. He's a visiting instructor in the College of Veterinary Medicine and a wildlife veterinarian here on the Urbana-Champaign campus of the University of Illinois. Our discussion surrounding box turtles, eastern box turtles, to define them more succinctly. When we last spoke with him, we had just gotten to the point of how they find these eastern box turtles. They use dogs that sniff out the turtles. I almost hate to ask this, Matt, but you said that the owner had trained them to find box turtles. I suspect he had a reason to do that. What was it?
I actually probably don't know the original intent. He's an unofficial herpetologist, non-academic herpetologist, let me say, from South Carolina, always had an interest in reptiles. And I believe he just acquired one of the dogs, was taking them out hiking, and the dog showed a propensity to finding turtles. And I think that led him to decide, wow, this might be the species, the breed that's helping me, you know, increase our turtles. And so he had a few dogs, and they were all doing very well. And it had spread through the herpetology world that he had dogs that were able to find turtles. And finding turtles, again, is one of the most difficult portions of doing any field study with the species. And so any mechanism that can non-invasively increase the number of turtles, people are often intrigued by. And so one of my collaborators, who is a high school biology teacher in Tennessee, but had started his own not-for-profit environmental research organization, got in contact with this gentleman through numerous social contacts, and they had come over and found that indeed it had worked. And those dogs have actually traveled all around the country within the last couple of years significantly. They were used earlier in May in Illinois up to find ornate box turtles. And I saw the video from those searches, and ornate box turtles are extremely difficult to find. And the dogs were just doing amazing work. They found a couple hundred turtles within 2 days. And so it really makes things significantly better in order to be able to assess the real population size and prevalence of diseases specifically is what I'm looking for. The more numbers I get, the more accurately I can define that population.
How many turtles have you found this season? I assume you have a turtle hunting season of some sort. So
yeah, usually reptiles are, again, use all their metabolism is generated from external sources, the sun. And so they're active during the periods when it's warm enough. Typically, they emerge in March, April, and then they overwinter in September, October when it starts to get cooler. So anytime between that active season is usually what we use. This year, we're done collecting samples for the most part. We went from May, end of May, until the beginning of August, and we collected 200 box turtles.
Now, you say you collected, but you didn't actually keep them. You tagged them or yep. did something with them. What do you do with them when you get hold of them?
So we weigh them. We mark them with a unique identification number. And there's different methods that biologists have used in the past. Usually it's making notches in the shell or something of that nature, putting a micro chip transponder in them, those kind of things. And so all of that is performed. And then this summer, I had a student that went down to Tennessee that collected the turtles, helped to collect the turtles, and she took a blood sample, and she took a swab of the mouth. There, we record their GPS location, the relationship to the nearest tree, relationship to the nearest stream, and then they're released immediately.
You can tell how old they are.
You can get an idea. They have growth rings, annular rings that are that we typically use from the bottom of their shell or the plastron, but that only correlates to their growing seasons. And so a lot of times that will correlate annually, but when they're young, they can sometimes they can go through two growth spurts or three growth spurts within a year. So if you see three bands, it doesn't necessarily mean it's a three-year-old turtle. It could mean that animal is 1 year old but had three growth spurts in that particular year. And then when we get up to past 20 bands, things start to really go together and move together, and you're not able to tell. So we're able to tell a pretty good range from when the animal is about four to about 18 or 19, specifically on a 2 or 3 year period when they were probably born. And then greater than 20 is how we classify them, or neonates or juveniles.
You talked about here in the state of Illinois, two types of turtles, the ornate and the box. Are there others?
There are numerous other turtles, no other tortoises, box turtles. The difference between a turtle and a tortoise typically is tortoises are land animals only, and turtles are freshwater aquatic animals, or terrapins is what we call them. And we have lots of those, and those are the ones that people are probably familiar with, red-eared sliders, painted turtles, musk turtles, snapping turtles, those types of things. And we have lots of those. And some of those populations, like Blanding's turtles, which we have in the state, are decreasing significantly. It's an endangered species. Probably we don't have significant population numbers that are going to call for long-term sustainability. That species will probably be extinct in the state.
Finally, Matt, we've got maybe 30 seconds or so. You're a wildlife veterinarian. What does that mean?
Yeah, so I had my undergraduate degree in ecology. I went to vet school. I did a master's in conservation health that was looking at reptiles specifically. And then I did a residency specifically in zoological medicine at the Knoxville Zoo and the University of Tennessee. And so I had specific training. And now I'm back. I'm to Illinois, my alma mater, and teaching wildlife and zoological medicine to our veterinary students.
We're so glad you're here and so glad you took time with us today. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for having me.
Matt Allender is a visiting instructor, a wildlife veterinarian here on the Urbana-Champaign campus of the University of Illinois in the College of Vet Med. I'm Todd Gleason. This has been The Farming World.